Hey, and welcome to the In Her Lens podcast. My name is Nadine, and I'm your host. And this podcast focuses on underrepresented perspectives in film and television. This season, I've been looking at film in the fight against climate change. Where is the industry confronting our new reality? And where is it not? Who is working at this intersection? I'm proud today to be joined by two fantastic women, Lucy Stone and Victoria Stevenson, of the organization Climate Spring. Climate Spring is a global company using the power of the screen to transform how people see and respond to climate change. Now, Climate Spring offers early stage development funding for scripted and unscripted content, high level pro bono editorial consulting on climate elements of feature film and TV projects for writers, commissioners, and producers. They provide both training and writer development opportunities, like their program, The Hot House. By informing, inspiring, and incentivizing mainstream content makers to explore climate stories in a more impactful way, Climate Spring is aiming to help transform society's response to the climate crisis. Lucy Stone is the founder of Climate Spring. She is a leading narrative change expert and a climate innovator, having set up many successful organizations and initiatives. Lucy has been a leader in philanthropy, in social enterprise, advising UN organizations and governments. Victoria Stevenson is a member of Climate Spring's Board of Trustees. She is an executive producer of feature-length documentary film. In 2012, she started Influence Film. And since, Influence has executive produced and or funded over 50 films, including the Emmy Award-winning Trophy and the Sundance Audience Award winner and BAFTA nominee Beyond Utopia. In today's episode, Lucy opens up about Climate Spring's mission, and Victoria tells us about the power that she sees in narratives mobilizing people in affecting change. I ask them about who they have identified as gatekeepers and about the efficiency belief. We talk about their development funds like The Hot House, the panel of experts, and maybe most importantly, we also discuss entrepreneurship, funding, and starting a company that's invested in investment. I'm really grateful to Lucy and Victoria for making time for us. I feel really hopeful after this conversation, and I hope conversations like this one and the ones in this season are holding for you not the dread, which is often instilled in us in this climate justice fight, but really rather, I hope by you meeting these people, these artists and scholars and business champions, that you see and find the power that you really hold in our collective journey. Okay, sorry, little rant. I'm done ranting now. I hope that you'll enjoy this inspiring duo working at one of today's most innovative and passionate organizations. Here are Lucy Stone and Victoria Stevenson on In Her Lens.
Welcome to In Her Lens. Thank you both so much for being here. I start off this season usually, or the previous seasons, with quickfire questions, and I've adapted them now to four questions about the seasons. We have two people in this call, Lucy and Victoria, so you'll get two answers as a listener. Are you guys both game to answer those four questions?
We are indeed, yes.
Oh. Thank you.
Okay. The first question is spring. What is the first thing that you do in the morning when you wake up?
Make a cup of tea. Make a cup of tea.
Have a cup of coffee.
And come with kids.
Beautiful. The next question is about summer. I'm a big music fan. If you could go to any concert tonight, somebody who's still alive, somebody's passed, who would you go see?
I would so go to Taylor Swift. I really want to see her concert.
Good one, good one. And Lucy?
I wish I'd seen Prince live.
Oh.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes. Taking a moment for that. The fall question is quite simple. I think we almost answered it. But tea or coffee person, Victoria?
One coffee in the morning, but then tea for the rest of the day.
Beautiful.
Tea, yeah, definitely tea person.
And the winter question is, do you have a resounding word or phrase or mantra that you carry with you in your days?
If you can dream it, you can do it.
Oh, I like that. That's good. Calm in the face of crisis is just a phrase that's ringing through my head at the moment.
That is a very, very good one.
I don't know if I always succeed, but, you know, try.
I mean, that is, I think, life altogether, mm-hmm. always trying to manage the crises. So I think that is a very good transition word to head into what we're talking about today. So we're here to talk about Climate Spring. You're both directors at this global organization founded in 2022, which is committed to developing, commissioning, and supporting scripted climate storytelling. I would love to get to know both of you a little bit more personally before we talk about the work that you do. Lucy, you're the founder of Climate Spring. Where are you from? And maybe a more personal question. Did you have a favorite teacher growing up, and why was that your favorite teacher?
Thank you, Nadine. Yeah, so I grew up in kind of very rural West Country, kind of near Stonehenge is the place people know. And when I grew up, we kind of climbed all over Stonehenge. It wasn't really a popular tourist kind of spot at the time. So I grew up really within nature, very kind of close, felt closely entwined within nature. And my favourite teacher at school was probably my music teacher, actually, because my music teacher kind of got us out of the classroom and got us to try different instruments and feel confident and get us singing and kind of injected the sort of joy of life into all of us, I think. Yeah, an amazing music teacher. But yes, grew up in the rural England.
Mm-hmm. And Victoria, you were also a fellow director at Climate Spring. What did your younger years look like? And do you remember maybe like a favorite book or favorite film from your younger years that inspires you maybe still today?
Thank you. You know, this is a really great question because I've known Lucy for years and I never knew that about her. What is interesting is we had a shared similar upbringing, which again, I didn't know until now. I grew up on a farm down in Kent, a very rural upbringing, not climbing all over Stonehenge, but climbing all over ponies. So for me, it was, you know, kicked out of the house in the morning, take my pony and go on adventure with real freedom, but in nature, in wilderness, with my little dog. So love of animals and you know, love of the environment, I suppose. And sort of coming from a farming background, it's also important how you see how you manage the environment as well as how you be in it. So that's an interesting perspective. What book do I remember? All sort of, there's a lovely book and I can't remember the name of it. Flicker. It's called Flicker. Oh,
about the horse.
Girl, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And a pony, of course, in Oregon or somewhere, and it's all, you know, riding her pony in the middle of nowhere. But that was me. So I identified very strongly with that.
How long have you both known each other?
3 years, 4 years?
Mm-hmm. Maybe like 4 years, I think. Yeah. We had a good friend in common who put us in touch. We're both working on similar, you know, similar missions.
So let's talk about that mission. I want to talk about the, kind of the fundamental goals of Climate Spring. And I think we should start at the basis of why you've chosen to look at this crisis with a lens of film and TV and storytelling. You know, research shows that narratives and stories have a real power in helping people or helping to get people mobilized around this issue. I guess this is a question for you, Lucy. Do stories differ from narrative in definition, and what makes them so powerful in affecting change?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I mean, we know stories are the medium that people have communicated with each other for since the beginning of time. You know, they're the vehicle in which we tell each other what matters. We tell each other who we are and what our values are, and inspire, make us laugh. And, you know, they're everything from entertainment to really kind of deep, profound ways of seeing seeing your relationship with each other in the world. And narratives kind of, for me, narratives underpin everything. I mean, narratives are our interpretation of how we see the world. And that it's something very subtle, and it's not always obvious to see it. So a story, you know, has a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know, and a story hooks you in and has an emotion, often an emotional hook, in a way that facts and figures, you know, really don't. But a narrative underpins all of that. And a narrative at the moment that I think has been driving a lot of the climate crisis is a narrative that says, you know, fossil fuels are the backbone of the economy. Fossil fuels make us happy. You know, and without fossil fuels, we go back to the dark ages and we've got to live in a cave and give up all our quality of life. Mm. And that's a successful narrative that the fossil fuel industry has deliberately seeded through culture. And they've seeded it through storytelling culture, particularly because they know how powerful that is as a medium for understanding each other. And I think that kind of speaks to why we set up Climate Spring and why we focus particularly on scripted, but also on factual entertainment and entertaining stories, which is, you know, to say that we've done, I think the climate community has done a fantastic job of ringing the alarm bell and warning humanity with facts, quite terrifying, frankly, you know, facts and figures about where we're heading. And there's lots of good evidence to show that people get that, you know, across all demographic, across different countries and income and age and class, everybody is really genuinely quite scared about where we're heading and what's already unfurling in front of us. But what we're really missing is, what's the story to pull us through? And, you know, look at any crisis throughout history or any huge social issue. There's always a warning bell and there's always, good people trying to raise the alarm of injustice or, you know, where we're heading. But you always also need people to show you and paint a compelling picture about where we could go that's different. And really, that's the vision that you need to pull people through the crisis. And without that, we're kind of stuck in paralysis and in stasis. I think that's where we are collectively on the climate crisis. And storytellers, particularly storytellers working in screen and film and TV, are some of the best storytellers at really trying to inspire and picture and literally show the way through. So that's kind of why we set up Climate Spring and why we think stories and narrative have such a particularly important role to play.
And I guess a question for you, Victoria, how has like the science communication and science thought and reporting, how is that limited in involving the majority of the world in maybe the use of language, and how is that different when we use visuals or other kinds of storytelling methods?
I think film and TV have the power to move people emotionally. And I think that is the real marker in behavior change. You can read all the facts and figures in the world, you can do the research, but it doesn't. You need a sort of human connection. You need to feel transported to really, I think, move yourself in some way. I come from a background of making documentaries, and I've made quite a lot of documentaries over the years, and quite a lot of social issue documentaries. The most powerful one I have ever worked on, as far as impact goes, was a film called The Game Changers, which is about how eating vegan makes you strong and, by the way, helps save the planet. Now, we didn't come to it with lots of facts and figures about how if we all went plant-based, it would be great from an environmental perspective. We came to it from a perspective of how if you eat more plant-based, you will get stronger, you will be fitter, you will live longer, and you might also be a bit more sexy. And we were really blatant about this. We filmed athletes covered in oil, like a Sports Illustrated shoot, but we made it aspirational. We made it cool. We made it, this is where you want to go. We got people emotionally. And rather than reading a very dry research report about the climate emergency, if you can world build, if you can inspire people, Or that's one example. The other way is moving people by a personal story that gets your sympathy or your empathy or any of those human emotions. That's how you move people, I think. And that's where film and TV are so uniquely placed, I think.
Mm-hmm. Lucy, will you tell us three things specifically about Climate Spring and the three focuses maybe that drive this mission forward?
So at its core, we have development funding, and that sounds really kind of simple, but we found it's been a really key sort of catalyst. You know, there are lots of incredibly talented existing talent within the industry, screenwriters, directors, producers, who really want to tell the story of our time. You know, climate crisis is the biggest story of our time. They really want to engage in that. Commissioners are increasingly wanting to commission stories. We know audiences are increasingly wanting to see content on their screen that reflect the unfurling crisis outside the window. What's missing is a combination of being able to prioritize that within a very commercial, fast-paced industry, and giving the kind of hand-holding advice so that, as Victoria says, they don't have to be an expert, they don't have to read all the really boring climate reports and all the data and become experts. So we support that in really practical ways. We have development funding, but we also kind of partner alongside the team as to be their experts, to connect them up to if they need to speak to a flooding expert or somebody who can talk about why veganism is so important for the climate crisis. It kind of shortcuts a lot of the research and development that the production company would have to do, and then mm-hmm. speeds it along the process. And then that's one way. The second way is, we're kind of a neutral space between the creatives and the producers, the commissioners, who we talk to a lot and get a sense of, you know, what they're looking for and what the market gaps are, what likely get greenlit. And then the kind of climate world, the climate community that is, you know, immersed in a sense of what the narratives that are needed to seed and shift the climate crisis, politics and social space. So we're kind of in that space between, and so we can provide that connectivity to the commissioners and also the kind of practical climate community linkages. Mm-hmm. Victoria, what have I missed? Those are the kind of main ways that we can support.
I think you've covered it.
You talk about working with gatekeepers. What do you see as a gatekeeper? Who are these people in this industry, for people who don't know? And why do we call them gatekeepers?
Mm. Victoria, do you want to say a bit about this?
Yes. I mean, I suppose the gatekeepers in this instance are controllers of channels, commissioners, broadcasters, to some extent, production companies. The people who are holding where the content can be dispersed from, made from, so sort of mm-hmm. industry insiders.
Yeah, you know, the people who are actually investing in making the content or greenlighting it, mm-hmm. commissioning it, as Victoria said, or buying it to distribute mm-hmm. on their channels. And they obviously have, you know, huge influence in terms of what gets made, what gets out there in the world, what we see on our screen, but also shaping the pipeline of content that's coming towards them. So yeah, key part of the industry.
And how do you develop a relationship with these figures? Is this something that has come quite easily to you in this? Because I mean, it's been about a year and a bit. How has that developed, maybe from when you first started working to now a year later? What have you learned in that relationship dynamic?
Yes, really, it's been a really interesting journey. I mean, we launched, yes, a year and a half ago, but it was after a few years of consultation with the industry. And in fact, we actually started off on the basis of some discussions with some commissioners who were, well, we were asking this question, why are you not commissioning more climate content? What's right. stopping you? You know, and they said, mm-hmm. well, bring us more content and we want to commission it, but we're just not getting good commercial content coming our way. So that was a sort of challenge set to us, and that's how we, you know, and how we designed Climate Spring. So it's been a few years of really that kind of deep conversation with commissioners to understand what they need
And it's just building up their trust and relationship. And I think what's helped is they know that we're this sort of neutral space. We're not the creatives or the production companies ourselves. We can suggest and make bring them projects or make introductions, or the production companies will bring the projects. But we've got a good kind of view of the themes and types of projects that are coming through. So it's a sort of, yeah, building up that trust and reputation that we're coming from within the industry. We're not just climate activists trying to tell the industry how to do their job, we're quite practically involved. And so we also have, there's two other directors also from film and TV industry backgrounds. And then we have a fantastic industry advisory group who are all, have backgrounds as buyers and sellers and distributors in the industry. And that really, I think, has helped build up our relationships. But it's, you know, it's always a work in progress to keep developing those relationships and credibility, Victoria.
I think to your point, I think that's really important, is that we're not climate people learning to make content. Mm-hmm. We are all content people who are learning, mainly from Lucy, about climate. So I think as directors, we are already got lots of experience in working in film and TV. We understand the industry language. We have access to the places where people meet and convene. We're not outsiders, and I think that has really helped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one thing that I find myself running into as I'm getting to know all of these people and really exploring the topic of climate and film and how these two interact and intersect, as you were saying, all of these commercial fast-paced projects in the commercial fast-paced industry that film and TV is, what kind of storytelling is the climate crisis demanding from us at this moment? And I don't want to be cynical, but is it possible in this fast-paced world that we're living in and this like content push that is happening, how is that meeting each other in your perspective, maybe starting with Lucy?
It's such a good question. And, you know, there's no kind of perfect science, is there? Because it's an art, storytelling, and it's an experiment, and some will hit the mark and some won't. And, you know, it's partly why we're trying to support a huge range of different projects, some more serious in tone, some more lighthearted, because, you know, we need to appeal to different people in different ways where they're at. Mm-hmm. You know, and as somebody who has worked on climate change for most of my life, at the end of the day, if I want to switch on the TV, it's really not to feel really depressed. Yeah. To be given lots of information about how terrible the climate crisis is. I want to be moved. I want to cry or laugh or, you know, have an escape. So I think those are the stories we need. And the balance is not being flippant about something that's very serious, where, you know, lives are at stake, but also not being too heavy-handed, that you create a sense of hopelessness. And it's a balance. It's a definite balance act. But the stories that we need, I think, have got to be rooted in an understanding of the seriousness, but a really, really clear-sighted view that we still have a chance to turn this around. It's not too late. And we have all the solutions. And this is totally doable, that we can do this. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be hard. And it's the archetypal journey story. You know, we need to journey as humanity through and away from a really destructive way of living and a really destructive course that we're on. We need to navigate away from that rapidly. And the journey is going to be tough. We're already in it, and we can see how tough it already is.
Yeah,
but we can navigate through it to somewhere quite fundamentally different. And I really believe, and in fact, it's not a question of belief. There's a ton of evidence to show this. The latest UN report on climate change showed that actually there's a positive story about climate change that never gets told, which is all the solutions to climate change will actually make us all better off. They'll create better equality. They'll create better quality of life. And, you know, it just so happens to be that a lot of those solutions are the same solutions that the World Health Organization is saying we need for to deal with the health, you know, the health issues that we're dealing with, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is a solvable problem. That's the story we need to be told. And it needs to be done in a way that is inspiring and exciting and not boring and worthy and make everyone feel hopeless and depressed, I think.
You're so right, Lucy. And you're, the way you talk about it is so inspirational. So mm-hmm. It's so nice to hear.
Yeah.
I would just add a very sort of boring side note, which is it's also about making content that doesn't just speak to the church that's already in the conversation. It's about making kids programs that speak to children. It's about making, you know, entertainment programs that people who are traditionally maybe centre-right, not necessarily supportive of climate action. It's really broadening the content remit. So it reaches as many stakeholders as possible, not people just looking for climate messaging or climate content. Because I think you can find climate content if you look at the news or you go to specific outlets. It's mm-hmm. more that there isn't enough of the inspirational work that Lucy's talking about, but that sort of mainstream, easily accessible by everybody. We need our challenges to weave this into as much varied content as possible to move as many people as possible, to bring everybody with us.
Yeah, because what I've noticed just as somebody who goes to the movies, like the big stuff that I see in all the bigger movie theaters, I have just spent quite a lot of time in Mongolia. There's one movie theater there with two screens and the movies that get played there. And if you have a big blockbuster, that a lot of the cli-fi stories that are being made are very often doomsday, worst mm-hmm. day in the world.
Right.
And if that's the only thing that you're, if you don't watch TV and you go to this movie theater, it's on a screen, it feels important. That feels more realistic than smaller planet placement, separating trash, mm-hmm. things like this. Yeah.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it says something about where we are as society now, doesn't it? That we've lost that world building vision. If you think back to the 60s, the 70s, you think of sci-fi movie, big blockbuster films. The world building of Hollywood then was highly optimistic. Okay, it was very tech focused. You know, we'll be, you know, driverless cars and, you know, mm-hmm. whatever, you know, incredible cityscapes. But it was immersed in a sense that the future's there us to shape. You know, this future's there mm-hmm. for us to design. And I think it says a lot that we've really lost that at the moment, and that mm-hmm. most you know, futuristic films are either deeply apocalyptic, which reflects mm-hmm. the kind of psyche of where we are. People feel deeply hopeless about our future, but also have lost that ability to show an incredible array of possible alternative futures that we might be living in. There's one exception to this, but it hasn't yet seeped into mainstream culture and film and TV, which is a kind of solar punk culture. It's very kind of subculture at the moment, but it's really deeply hopeful, beautiful visuals of city living that is sustainable without being worthy, that is colourful and bright and engaging and compelling. But it says a lot that that's a subculture at the moment. It's not mainstream right. culture, and that's what we want to try and change at Climate Spring.
Yeah, which you are doing through also a thing called Hot House, which I would love to talk about, because I think it's also, I mean, In Her Lens is, it was really born out of my love and desire to understand and heighten and expand representation in film and TV. And that started off with the perspective of looking specifically at people, at women. But I think now we've grown into just, you know, I really want as many people at the forefront of making story, because I also find story so important. And Hot House is a really cool way to involve all these new and exciting content makers from so many different backgrounds. So the one of you, please explain to us what Hot House is and how it functions within Climate Spring.
Yes, no, you're exactly. We totally share your focus. So because our model has been, you know, very, very much as kind of working within the industry, sadly, that means we're working with a very undiverse pool of talent quite often, because that's where the industry is at the moment. So we set up Hot House to give opportunities for pitches from newer writers struggling to break into an otherwise, you know, structurally unequal industry. And we simply set it up as a competition. So you could apply with your idea, with your treatment, and the winning chosen applicants were supported with funding, but also guidance and support and a mentorship. And we were completely overwhelmed by the number of applications we got, over 500, I think, wasn't it, Victoria?
Oh, wow.
We did it with the BBC and BFI. So it was just in the UK. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting was a really diverse range of applicants, both in terms of gender, race, class, etc. But also a lot of the applications were actually pretty experienced writers. So they were not all kind of fresh film school grads, you know, who've never done anything before, which also speaks to the structural inequality, I think, of the industry, but also speaks to the appetite and the desire and the interest in, you know, in
100%.
This topic.
Yeah. How do you choose your people? How did you manage those 500 applicants?
Oh my God.
Where do you start?
It was so hard, wasn't it, Victoria? Yeah. It was really difficult.
We had some readers from the BBC and the BFI, and then we had some readers from the BBC and the BFI to share the load, and then the directors all read some, and then we had a very complicated marking system that put certain ones through, and then two of us read them, and it was a sort of process of breaking down. But I think, and I'd be interested in what you think, Lucy, I think what was so interesting was there were some really wide-ranging ideas and really some pretty brilliant things came through. The final decision was quite tricky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of good ideas there that could have been taken forward. We anonymized the submissions, so we weren't, you know, to sift out our own bias. Yeah. So we didn't know the name or the gender or any of the concept. So we just selected them on merit of the idea. But then we did analyse for, you know, to look at how many, you know, who was applying and then who we selected at the end. And actually it was quite a good range from a diversity perspective. But yes, it was really difficult to choose them. And we're supporting them at the moment. And it's very exciting seeing the projects develop. And there's already some interest from production companies for some of those. We're feeling excited about that.
Yeah, super exciting. And how does that, did they come with a pitch, or did some people already come with like a further developed script? And I know that you have this panel of experts that you also currently consult on things. Are these people also involved with Hot House?
Yeah, some of them had already, you know, written a script or started writing a script. Some of them, it was really just a concept, an idea. So it's quite a range. And yes, the advisory group, we haven't involved so much in the Hot House because we tend to involve the advisory group when it's a project we're investing in to sort of take to the next stage. But we have, that's the next stage. We will involve the advisory group. And because we had the BFI and BBC involved, they were sort of essentially also a part of the advisory group for that, for the Hot House. And we're hopefully rolling out the Hot House to other geographies as well, so across Europe and fingers crossed Australia as well.
Okay, I also want to talk about finances, and that might look really good with Hot House. You know, money is something that people skip around, and that is something that I am also actively trying to work on in this series, is, you know, how do we as entrepreneurs uplift each other, successful developments, things like this. I know that once a project gets picked up, it helps fund Climate Spring further. What advice would you have for people who have a new business or a new idea that they want to further develop in making it financially realistic in terms of partnerships, things like that?
My background is making films, so I'm quite good at getting money out of films, for films. But Lucy is the fundraising queen.
I mean, I love that you're highlighting that, Nadine. I mean, you're absolutely right. We can't skirt around this. We're not doing this for free. We need to get paid. You know, we've got kids to raise and bills to pay. So, Yeah, so we're paid by philanthropy. So philanthropic foundations fund Climate Spring. And then when we fund a project, it's as development funding, it's an investment actually rather than a grant. So we're not a grant-making foundation. We invest, and it's not significant amounts because it's development funding. So it's small amounts of funding. But we found that's been really helpful because obviously it means it can be prioritized if you're paid to work on a project, even if it's a small amount. It means you can prioritize that project, even if it's for a few weeks. You know, you can prioritize mm-hmm. that above another project, and you're being paid for it. You know, you're treating it seriously. It's a job. It's not a voluntary activity.
Right.
So it's investment, not because we're trying to make a profit. You know, we're trying to have a climate impact ultimately. But it is an investment, so that again, it's kind of taken seriously as an investment in a project that ultimately we think can have a commercial success, will have a commercial return, and that's a key criteria. It needs to be commercially viable to work in the industry. So, and then the other ways that we support will sometimes make introductions to other funders. Can't always guarantee that. There isn't a huge amount of funding. Mm-hmm. And then obviously once a production company takes on a project, they will then go and sell the project, pitch it out to commissioners and try and get it bought. So they would kind of take on at that stage. I don't know, Victoria, anything else you'd add? I mean, it is difficult. There isn't a huge amount of development funding, which is why mm-hmm. even a small amount of development funding can really make a difference, we found.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, film and TV is a money-making business. So mm-hmm. if we have to be supporting commercial projects. So if we can invest in projects for success, then they should become self-supporting and self-funded mm-hmm. of the development process if we're doing our job right. So, you know, that's part of our strategy, is to engage in the world commercially rather than just as a grant giving
body. Yeah. Yeah. You also have some virtual community events. You have a newsletter. Looking forward, what are some of Climate Spring's goals?
Yeah, this is a new part of our work that we really developed just on the basis of all the conversations with the creatives that we work with, because mm-hmm. we work with them all individually on their different projects. They were all saying to us, basically, they felt they were, you know, it's a lonely business, writing anyway, isn't it? You're toiling away on your project mm-hmm. on your own. But they all, you know, had this feeling that, am I the only writer writing a climate story in this otherwise horrendously commercial industry, you know? Am I the only one that cares about this, that's having sleepless nights about this topic? And literally just creating community so that they feel part of something bigger, they feel part of a movement, but can also, from a peer-to-peer perspective, just share their shared creative challenges and creative experience mm-hmm. in grappling with this issue. We found that's been really, there's a real hunger for that. So we've just, started organising some get-togethers in person and online. We've got our Substack newsletter, and we're just generally trying to kind of build a bit of a community, which is now global, starting off in the UK, but now are sort of joining up the dots internationally, as it is a bit of a movement in every industry. It's happening. You know, there are people within each industry grappling with the question of how they play their role in the climate crisis within their industry. And the more we can bring people together so you feel part of something bigger, the more it catalyzes a greater movement.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you're looking at the statistics or when you're not looking at the positive story that Lucy spoke about earlier, it's quite easy to get depressed about where we are and mm-hmm. what we're doing. And there's a, you know, being part of a movement and being feeling that you're not the only one doing this work is inspiring. And I think keeps us all optimistic and focusing in the right way.
Yeah. And I think one big thing I have learned, and what I realize as I'm talking to all these different people, is like how important community is in these crises, like how much, and also the cyclical nature of nature and then of us as humans and how much we actually need each other.
Yes, it's actually what I'd almost say it's one of the solutions to climate.
Yeah.
It's a sense of community. There's great stories of communities that have faced huge natural disasters the communities that are strongest survive the best. I know it sounds intuitive, but when you're faced with an emergency, you need to know who's vulnerable, where to look for somebody, know who to reach out to for help. And that sense of care doesn't have to be a community, a physical community of proximity. It can be a virtual community. Mm. And it's absolutely key, because things are going to get difficult before they get better. There's no doubt. And that sense of community and helping each other out is part of the climate crisis solution, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Let's say I was coming with a pitch. What are some ways that some advice you have for people who are starting off with, like, I really want to write a climate story? What are some trends that you're seeing or things that you're interested in right now, maybe starting with Victoria?
So I'm really interested in finding things that aren't typical. That might be a factual entertainment TV series. I'd love to see some carbon solutions in cookery or home decoration, or the programs you see on all the listings that you don't necessarily find climate embedded into. I also really want to see some comedy or some love stories or something that take people somewhere different, so they're in a different place when they come across a climate story. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I would be really interested in, finding unusual ways that reach different audiences with climate messaging.
And I would add to that to say, I would love to see some really strong world building where,
yes,
project, you imagine whatever the country you want to set your story in, you imagine that country in 10 years. It doesn't have to be far, far future, but the nearer future, the better. Set it in 5 to 10 years' time, in a future in which we have transitioned away from fossil fuels and we've transitioned away from a highly extractive, destructive lifestyle. What would that look like? And set your story in that. So that's the backdrop to your story. And your story doesn't have to be anything to do with climate change. In fact, it would be a love story, or it would be, you know, a coming of age story. But in the backdrop of it, you visualize it, and you can have so much fun with that, of depicting what it looks like. And there are pockets of those of the future already now. They exist already now. It's a question of finding them and telling them, but also having some fun with it and having some creative fun imagining what that world looked like. Those are the stories I would also love to see.
Mm-hmm. I really feel the joy also, and if I just think of climate spring, it is jumping into something, and like, everyone's invited. So I'm very excited about what you have created. Very grateful that it exists. And thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting us on. And thank you for what it's doing.
Thank you for joining us. A massive thank you to Lucy and Victoria. I've linked Climate Spring's work as well as their development lab in the episode notes. I'm really interested and dedicated to this seemingly simple idea of making accessible, mainstream, fun, and inspirational work. Is there anything that comes to mind when you hear this, and any examples of this kind of work in climate stories? Let me know. And if you have an idea, go and find companies like Climate Spring that will help you actualize them. Any thoughts on this or previous episodes, you can always send us an email, inherlenspodcast@gmail.com, or you can join the conversation on Instagram @inherlenspodcast. This season keeps unraveling, and we have many more special conversations coming up. So I'll see you next week. Bye.